I'm fair but partly cloudy.
Well, you know, so is, I mean, for those of you who are listening in the Willamette Valley area.
Yeah, you actually had a respite from the rain. You know, I must have totally adapted to the Pacific Northwest. I reveled in the rain.
Well, you know, I think...
And I was actually out in it, walking in it, having to walk in it without, you know, catching or driving, too. So, you know, I was in it.
Well, I don't know if I reveled in it, but I'm certainly used to it so that it doesn't bother me as it once did.
Yeah, and you know, and I'm thankful because it's not like I'm immune to seasonal affective disorder. I did have that once and I was down for the count. One day I wasn't functioning and I thought, oh my goodness, it's finally hit me. It's about after 10 or 11 years or so of living here and it like hit me and I was, you know, I needed to deal with it. I needed to get a little help so I could make it through. It was a rough winter. But this year, I remember last week I was out walking to work, catching the bus, and thinking how much calmer this pace was. And I had taken the Max in, and I read, and I slept, and it was lovely. And then I got to walk out and smile at people. And, you know, yes, it was wet, but I had on my coat and my waterproof shoes, and I just rode with it, you know.
That's it. That's so the way to...
That's the way.
Exactly.
That was my real enjoyment of the rain, you know. And then I guess I was the typical Northwesterner because I had a hot beverage in my hand too. So you know, there I was.
Well, that's it. You made it. You are Northwesterner.
I'm Northwesternized.
Pacific Northwesternized.
Yeah.
But for those of you who have not been Northwesternized, you only have 5 months and 23 days
five
before.
Weeks. Don't say 5 months. You'll have, you know, people committing mass, you know, weather side.
Weather side.
Yeah, mass weather side. 5 weeks.
5 weeks.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, it will soon change. So
and the days are longer anyway.
The days, I noticed that it's like, you know, you leave work and it's still light outside.
Yes.
So
you don't feel like a mushroom.
So, you know, no longer do I, well, I do. In the morning, it's still dark, but... Well,
okay.
But in the meantime, what's going on? Announcements?
No announcements. Anything I had, I either made over the weekend or they have become moot. They've gotten a little old.
Okay.
So that's it.
Okay. Well, this morning we'll have joining with us Loretta Ross, who is has been a guest, if not on this program, on KBOO. We will be talking on various issues. He's a nationally known human rights activist. And among the issues we will talk about is the nomination of Samuel Alito to the United States Supreme Court. Tomorrow, I believe on Tuesday, the Judiciary Committee will take a vote, and then it will head towards the United States Senate. For those of you who are concerned about this nomination, there have been many people who continue to organize around it. And here in Oregon, there have been lots of people who have urged a filibuster of Alito. In point of fact, more than 32,000 Oregonians have signed a petition opposing the confirmation of Samuel Alito to the Supreme Court. There is a move to filibuster the Alito nominations. And so we'll talk more about Alito and maybe the process itself. But with Ms. Ross, we'll examine more about the man, his philosophy, and where we are headed as a nation. Ms. Ross' expertise includes a number of issues, among those reproductive rights, human rights, women issues, hate groups, and bias crime. She is located in Atlanta, Georgia, and as I mentioned, is a nationally known human rights advocate and writes extensively around these issues. So joining us in a few minutes will be Loretta Ross, and certainly, as a part of our conversation, this is Talk Radio. We will invite you to join us in the conversation. So after a while in our introduction with Ms. Ross, we invite you to give us a call at 503-231-8255. 8187 and share in the conversation about Ms. Ross. And with Ms. Ross.
Yeah.
About Mr. Alito.
Right, about Mr. Alito. And I don't know how much of an introduction that you gave, but I did want to mention that Loretta Ross not only is the founder and the national coordinator of Sister Women of Song, Sister Song, Women of Color Reproductive Health Collective, composed of women of color organizations across the city. She's the co-director of the National March for Women's Lives in D.C. back in 2004, which was the largest protest in U.S. history. She's also the co-author of Undivided Right, Women of Color Organizing for Reproductive Justice. And she will also speak, as Cecil has said, with regard to issues of importance regarding how the proposed nominee will affect the, I guess, the makeup, I'll just say the makeup and the direction of the Supreme Court. So without further ado.
We'll talk with her shortly. I think we're still trying to get her.
Oh, still trying to get her connected.
But
is this not Monday?
Today
it
is
Monday.
And
This time of my tea. Let me have a sip, and then I can rejoin the human race.
Okay.
You take this.
Okay. Joining us now is Loretta Ross. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
How are you?
Oh, I'm fine. It's great in Atlanta.
Oh, great, great. We met a number of years ago when you were doing work around hate crimes and bias crimes, and I was a part of a doing some work here in Pacific Northwest. So it's good to hear your voice and good that you continue to struggle for good.
Great to talk to you again. And unfortunately, most of my trips to the Pacific Northwest have dealt with hate groups.
Right.
I think I've been to more Klan rallies than a black person should admit to.
But speaking of the Northwest, I noticed on a website, are you coming to Portland in April?
I'm coming to Portland in April, but I'm doing a Northwest tour in February, which will include Seattle, Spokane, Idaho, and I believe an event in Portland as well.
Okay, well.
And what is the focus of the event?
Well, I wrote a book last year along with three other authors called Undivided Rights. It's a history of women of color organizing in the reproductive health pro-choice movement. And this is the first case study detailing not what happened to women of color, but what we did for ourselves. It's actually quite popular to present this analysis. And so the National Organization for Women and a couple of other groups have gotten together to sponsor a Northwest tour so I can talk about reproductive politics and women of color.
Well, excellent. Speaking of a reproductive choice, I just saw in the newspaper this morning, there's a LA Times Washington Post article, and it talks about lawmakers in several states who are gearing up to force the Supreme Court to revisit Roe v. Wade. And among their proposals are some very draconian proposals sought in a way to force the issue. It's as if the more conservative forces feel as if their moment is about to arrive, and with the possible acceptance or the vote of Alito on to the Supreme Court, many feels that those who have opposed Roe v. Wade will have their way in coming years. Are people crying wolf around Mr. Alito, do you think?
Well, no, I think the Republicans, now that they own all three branches of government that, according to the Constitution I read somewhere, are supposed to be separate, they're chomping at the bits. They can't wait to get to Roe and overturn it. And let's be clear, their abortion strategy is part of a larger strategy of overturning quite a few civil rights and human rights protections. And so as concerned as I am about Alito and his possible swing vote in reversing Roe, which we can talk about more because there's some debate whether it's actually going to be reversed, I'm concerned about the fact that he hasn't, like most civil rights legislation that's come across his desk, he's offered very little worker protection in his decisions that have come across his desk. So he's very typical of the whole right-wing assault on all civil and human rights, which includes women's rights. So I don't want to narrow the focus on Alito only to abortion, even though that's very, very important. But we should be looking at the whole panoply of threats that he offers. And I'm not seeing a lot of spine out of the Democrats in opposing that nomination.
Oh, well.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I only got to hear part of one of the sessions for his hearing. And on that particular session, it sounded as though they were actually trying to deal with Alito's his way for determining the validity of choosing which procedures he wanted to do. The argument settled around whether or not he would advocate for one procedural basis or another. And one case had to do with a gentleman who was, I believe he was developmentally challenged. And there were certain factors that had not been brought forth in his case during the briefing or the initial part of the hearing. And Alito then decided that he would not allow this extra information to be brought forth because it hadn't been broached earlier in the process. But in another argument that had to deal with the federal government and it's not bringing forth some important information, he decided to bring forth an obscure procedure which allowed him to mention this information on behalf of the government. And so it seemed as though they were really trying to nail down the frame of mind, the frame of reference that Alito uses in determining how to apply law to his cases. But overall, it sounds as though whoever that particular senator was, and his name is escaping my mind, he's probably the only one who demonstrated a real grasp of just how canny Alito can be in how he dissects and presents case law and cases.
Well, he does duck and dodge quite ably, and that really does raise a question in my mind for the American public. Should we confirm a nominee who's so evasive, who conveniently forgets that he belonged to a racist and misogynist club? I mean, these are the kinds of questions that go to integrity in my mind. And so what I think nominees should be forced to answer questions honestly, forthrightly, and if they choose to be evasive, I think that's a strike against them in terms of proceeding with the nomination process. No one should be awarded for being evasive and duplicitous. I mean, the only place in America where that's rewarded is when you're getting a nomination to the Supreme Court, apparently.
Or playing poker.
Or playing poker, right. Well, send him to Vegas and play poker with that kind of stonewalling, but not put him on a court that could affect our futures for the foreseeable 30 years. And so the whole nomination process, even though the senators were well-intentioned and some of them answered hardball questions, they didn't press him when he was so evasive. They didn't press him sufficiently, in my mind, when he was so evasive. And really, evasiveness is not a quality I look for in my leaders. I really do expect them to shoot the hip, to be straight with people. And when a politician ain't being straight, I actually do believe that there's a problem. And particularly when a candidate for the Supreme Court is not being straight, I think there's a bigger problem.
Well, can you elaborate on maybe why you think the Democrats have been so unforthcoming in the really important and deep and pertinent questions?
Well, part of it is that he is an adept and nimble evader, and so it almost takes a constitutional law scholar to follow his trail of crumbs, because he only offers crumbs, and you have to be quite sharp-eyed and well-versed in constitutional law and legal theory to follow him. So maybe they're not qualified to be the ones answering those questions. But part of it, I think, is that the Democrats fear, maybe correctly, that if they call the question on this series of Republican candidates that are allowed to evade questions, that if possibly in the future they get a chance to nominate their judge, a Democratic-leaning judge, to the bench, that they may be asked the same type of hard questions that they're afraid to ask Republican candidates. So they may be looking down the road and saying, well, we don't want this process to be but so revealing, because it may be used against us. I think that's a little cowardly. I mean, I'm looking for some Democrats with some cojones myself, but I'm no constitutional lawyer, and I'm certainly no legal scholar, but because of that, I don't presume to stand up there and try to question people who are, get people who are qualified to do that. And the fact that they've taken the filibuster off the table as an option is somewhat disappointing as well.
Well, I'm speaking of, continuing with the Democrats, in point of fact, some Republicans argue, in terms of the evasiveness of the nominee, that this is a, certainly if not long-held procedure, but certainly something that is honored. And they often point back to the confirmation hearing of Justice Ginsburg and say that she too was evasive, and so that what Alito and what Roberts did before him is part of a procedure in terms of avoiding answering specific questions.
Well, again, that's because the bar has been set so low. I mean, ever since the nomination of Robert Bork, if anybody can remember that, far back in the 80s, it seems like there's this gentleman's agreement in Congress to let nominees get away with evading questions so that they don't get opposed. And while it works in a limited way from a Democratic point of view, but the reality is that the Republicans have been able to use that much more cleverly than Democrats, because Republicans have had many more opportunities to make nominations. And it's really just not a good strategy.
We're speaking this morning with Loretta Ross, who is the founder and national coordinator of the Sister Song Women of Color Reproductive Health Collective, composed of 70 women of color organizations across the country. And continuing with our conversation about Mr. Alito, you mentioned that he represents a certain type of candidate. And you also alluded towards his background. Now, certainly he didn't develop in a vacuum, and he has an extensive history going back to his early career. It would be helpful for me, and I think our audience, if you could tell us why Alito is a dangerous nominee in terms of some of the issues he hold on to and some of his concerns.
Well, first of all, Mr. Alito, when he was applying for a job within the Justice Department, I believe under Bush, the first Reagan administration it might have been, he was then very proud to brag about his conservative credentials and his membership into this club he was in college that did not want blacks and other minorities and women admitted to college. And he was very proud of his conservative background. And so for him to now say he can't remember what he put on a job application means either you lied on that job application or you have the world's most selective memory. I choose to believe that he told the truth on the job application and is using selective forgetfulness to evade questions nowadays. I understand he's also had a couple of cases dealing with workers' rights and mm-hmm. workers' opportunities to bring suits against their employers, and he has sided almost unanimously with the employers in all of those cases. So protections for workers and immigrants seem like they would be at risk with him. And I'm one of those people that believe that if you belong to a racist organization at one point in your history, then I need to see some signs of repentance. I need to see something you've done that's redeemed you from that racist past. I mean, I think of Senator Byrd from West Virginia, who was in the Ku Klux Klan, who makes no secret of the fact that he repents, that he really regrets that decision. I haven't seen any signs of regret in Alito. I've just seen somebody speaking with forked tongue.
You're listening to More Talk Radio here on KBOO, 90.7 in the city, 91.9 in the Columbia River Gorge, 100.7 in the Willamette Valley, and on the web, it's KBOO.FM. This is More Talk Radio. We're speaking with Loretta Ross here. And speaking of the way that Samuel Alito would make sweeping changes in not only the composition but the direction of the Supreme Court, one of the things that you said really early is the fact that there are a number of areas in which he would make a major change, and you've noted some of them in terms of how he would support workers' rights, and we've talked briefly about how he would possibly handle issues such as affirmative rights and reproductive rights. But there's also some concerns about his basically supporting unilaterally any decisions coming out of the presidential office. And especially with regard to how much power the executive office has with regard to domestic surveillance, supporting the president's rights to basically, well, I hate to be blunt, but just say spy on its own citizens.
Well,
go ahead.
Well, absolutely. I mean, Senator Leahy, who, you know, really says that he has to oppose the nomination because the president is seizing unprecedented power. He is spying on American citizens. And we count on the Supreme Court to provide a checks and balances situation for the executive office. If the judiciary doesn't check the presidential power, who does? And so for the nominee to be so clearly favorable towards the executive branch and to really cave in and give in and justify anything that the executive branch has historically done is really troubling, because that does not provide the separation of powers that we are used to and should be used to assuming exists between the executive and the judiciary branch. And we should all be concerned about that. He would really place too much power in the hands of the president at the cost of the protective system of checks and balances in our Constitution.
Well, one of the things that I've heard that's been batted back and forth is the fact that the desire is to have judges who will interpret the Constitution as it was written. And so that
the
has been...
The original people.
Exactly. And, you know, and so... Well, yeah, it is scary. But so, you know, I've heard the conservative camps saying that, well, they're tired of the quote-unquote activist judges or those who will reinterpret it according to their particular agenda. Well, not only does Alito deny an agenda, but it seems to me that if the idea is to have someone act within the original scope of the Constitution and not reinterpret it, that perhaps they are really being disingenuous by saying that Alito would be a good candidate because he is looking to grant so much power to the executive branch. And why is it not being challenged, at least in that area?
Well, you'd have to ask the senators why they're not challenging in that area. I wish I had my crystal ball and could read their minds. But these original interpreters of the Constitution, I think there's some word for them, these constitutionalists
Constitutionalists,
believe in original doctrine, They are a scary bunch because, of course, the original Constitution not only did not include the likes of me and you.
Absolutely. It didn't include us as women.
And women and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
But think about it. These were slaveholders that were very concerned in protecting their entrenched power from the untutored masses of Americans.
Exactly.
And so they created an entire system around preserving the power of the elite. And to go back to that type of interpretation of the Constitution, it really would be dangerous. I mean, I think of the fact that in the Constitution, there's no spelled out right of privacy. The Constitution was silent on the question of privacy, but subsequent decisions by the Supreme Court have granted Americans the right to privacy. The Miranda rights, I mean, all kinds of rights have been subsequently interpreted into the Constitution that these originalists would rather be scrapped, and they're scary. I mean, I live in Georgia. I live in a state that fights over the Confederate flag as if these Southerners want another chance to refight the Civil War. So I'm very much caught up in people who romanticize an earlier time when their power was unchecked and unthreatened. And that is scary.
We're speaking with Loretta Ross about Samuel Alito nomination and about human rights in general. Our numbers are 503-231-8187. If you have a question or comment for Ms. Ross, we encourage you to give us a call. Again, our numbers are 503-231-8187. Earlier you mentioned how the Republicans have control over all branches of government, and it seems as if the nomination of Alito is a given. You mentioned that the Democrats have taken the idea of filibuster off the table. How do people organize when the odds seem to be so stacked against us?
Well, we again have to go back to our community mobilizing efforts. I mean, the only way to make them pay attention, particularly in the legislative branch of government, is to say we're not going to take it, and you keep shoving this stuff down our throats. You keep trying to get us to ignore the Abramoff scandal, the Karl Rove scandal, the spying on Americans. We're going to punish you legislatively. We're going to get you out of office. That's one tactic that we need to talk about. But I'm also concerned about something that nobody's talking about nowadays, and that is the integrity of our whole election process. I mean, we still are dealing with these diebold voting machines that we're not sure are counting the votes right. There was a story in the Washington Post this morning about the Secretary of State, I believe, of Florida, at least the guy who oversees the elections in Florida. I'm not sure if it's the Secretary of State. Mm-hmm. He did some testing to see if he could manipulate the results of the diebold voting machines and did so successfully four times by hacking into the system. And why these kinds of stories are not getting major media coverage is beyond me, because if our voting integrity cannot be protected, then we're not living in a democracy. We're living in something else, pretending to be a democracy. And so there's a lot we can do at the grassroots. We need to be interrogating our Secretary of State or whoever controls the voting in our states to make sure that our voting processes give us paper trails so that we can make sure that the equipment is working right. We need to be really relooking at the redistricting that the Republicans have overseen that is definitely favoring the GOP. I mean, there's a lot we can do, but the most thing we can't do is give up. I have a phrase, just because they want to screw you, there's no reason you can't screw back. That's the only way to enjoy it.
I don't know. I'm a little bit more selective than my partners. I like to think, you know, politics, they say, make strange bedfellows, but I have to cut, you know, I had to cut it somewhere. You know, one of the things that before we go to our callers, I just want to bring this up, too, so that we can put all of some of our main issues regarding Alito on the table. You've also mentioned I don't know if I got it from you or if I heard it on the news, but one of the biggest concerns that people have expressed with regard to Alito and his possible threat to Roe v. Wade is the fact that it would then challenge settled law. And it's that fear that I've heard manifested, at least out of some of the Democrats who have been opposing his nomination. Can you explain what that means for us? And then, before we go to our callers, kind of touch upon how that, again, challenges a lot of laws that have already been established, which we might see once again come to the fore, just like Roe v. Wade is coming to the fore again.
Well, why don't I say I'll attempt to explain it because, again, I'm no lawyer and I'm
no
constitutional expert. But when asked about Roe, he did say that he would not call that settled law and he had problems with the decision. Well, actually, that's a narrow set of things that I agree with him on. I actually have problems with part of the way Roe was decided myself, but that doesn't mean that I don't consider it settled law. When he says he doesn't believe Roe is settled law, then I wanted to ask him the question. I almost went through my television set because I was like, well, do you consider Brown v. Board of Education
exactly.
settled law?
Exactly.
I mean, if you're going to say nothing is settled and everything is up for grabs again, how far back will you go?
Well, what is the basis upon which he says that it is not settled law and that you agree?
Well, what I agree. Now, I really can't answer the first question because...
Okay, so he was elusive again.
My problem with Roe, as it was decided, is that it used a trimester system. Less regulation of abortion in the first trimester, increased regulation in the second trimester, and the most regulation in the third trimester. So it used a biologically based trimester system for the decision. I actually think that Roe should have been decided, as Sarah Weddington argued it, as a 14th Amendment discrimination case. There's one class of people in America who get pregnant. That's just one class, and until we can change the plumbing, we're going to continue to be that class. Because of our biology, we are subjected to all forms of pregnancy-related discrimination, whether it's time off from work, whether it's the right to have an abortion, whether it's the right to have child care. Women suffer from pregnancy-related discrimination, and since the 14th Amendment bans all forms of discrimination, I thought that Roe would have been stood on firmer ground under the 14th Amendment than the way it was decided under privacy in the trimester system, because privacy is not in the Constitution. It's inferred into the Constitution. And so as an African-American woman, I understand the discrimination that happens when someone else controls your body. Every black person understands that. And so I would have preferred Roe to have been decided as an act of discrimination, to prevent discrimination under the 14th Amendment. And that's very similar, by the way, to how the Canadian system is, because in Canada they define denying abortion as an act of discrimination. And it's written into their constitution, so they're not having these same kinds of crazy fights we're having.
Oh, Canada. It looks better every day.
Except for the weather. I could love that.
Well, they do have an election, so maybe I'll hold on moving.
Well, their conservatives are leading in the polls
because
of their closeness to the Bush administration, so we have some reason to be concerned north of the border.
We're speaking this morning with Loretta Ross about the Alito nomination and other issues. Give us a call at 503-231-8187 if you have a call, a question, or a comment. And let's go to a caller. Good morning, caller, and thank you for waiting.
Good morning.
Good morning. Hi, Loretta. I just wonder if you're kin to Lou Rawls.
I wish. I'll tell you, we have lost three major voices this, in the last year and a half between Luther, Wilson Pickett, and Lou Rawls. Music will never be the same.
Yeah.
But no, they're not cousins or anything.
Well, probably somewhere back there somewhere. But I'm so concerned and so disgruntled right now. The Bush creature is surrounded by Dick Cheney and Karl Rove and all the neocons who we. from observation, are psychotic, crazy people. And now he wants to put this Alito in, who I believe is named the Kingmaker. And what the heck are we going to do?
Well, first of all, we're going to stop calling them psychotic, crazy people. I mean, they're people who have the same kind of complex kinds of feelings that we all have. I mean, bad people do good things, and good people do bad things. So I try not to demonize people that I whose ideas I disagree with.
Well,
I mean, they are probably
they're convinced that
they're doing the
American
right thing based on the data they have.
Yeah, no, I stand behind my words there. Yeah. Just from what
if it's just old to call them crazy and explain their behavior that way, that works for you. It doesn't work for me because I actually do see them as rational people making very bad decisions.
Yeah, I don't see any rationality in murdering 100,000 Iraqis.
Well, it's rational from their point of view. They want to control the oil because God made a geological mistake. He put our oil under their sand.
There you go. So how do
we? Well, they think it's eminently rational.
Is there anything we can do to block the Kingmaker?
To block Alito?
Yeah.
Well, obviously we've got to communicate with our senators and let them know how we feel. But I happen to live in a state where our senators haven't listened to me in quite a while. But we've got two Republicans, and they send me these wonderful form letters when I write them, but they never do anything I want them to do. But I think we're going to have to agitate in the streets regarding the threat to Roe. Now, there is a question of whether or not Alito's going to be the swing vote that overturns Roe, or are they simply going to continue to chip away with it, at it. What I'm concerned about is that those of us in the women's movement aren't preparing for a post-Roe future.
Yeah.
Women are going to die if we don't start doing something differently. And the different thing I'd like us to do is to look at, can we restart hundreds of Jane collectives across the country? For your listeners that don't know, Jane was a private abortion service that feminists ran in Chicago pre-Roe, where they would help women get safe and then illegal abortions, but it kept women from dying. We need to be talking about doing that again, because it may be illegal, but there should be some of us who are willing to break the law to save a woman's life. And we're not having that kind of conversations right now, and I think that concerns me, because women will be dying while these boys play around. It's like Rome's burning while Nero fiddles.
Thank you for your call.
Thank you.
And we'll go to our next caller. Good morning.
Good
and
morning.
Thank you for waiting.
Good morning. I'm not here in the appointment of Judge Alito. There's one thing that I'm not hearing come up, and that's the fact that if we are a country of laws and the decisions of that set a precedent, how is the Supreme Court going to possibly act in the future with respect to discrepancies in voting, considering that we basically have a court-appointed president?
You mean a president-appointed court?
Yes. Well, yes, basically. I mean, it concerns me that there's a possible conflict if there's such a discrepancy even in voting and the actual wants and rights of the citizens of this country to vote, and through voting we elect who we want. What happens in the future with respect to us, you know, saying, okay, is it just about abortion, or is it about our rights as a block and determining where we go as a society? That's what I'm interested in, and I'm not hearing in the conversation with respect to questioning this judge. How does he feel about the courts intervening in matters such as electing our president?
Well, many of us who watched the 2000 elections were dismayed that the Supreme Court chose to intervene prematurely, we thought, and decide the outcome of a presidential election, which really did take the hands out of the decision out of the hands of the voters and put it on the Supreme Court, and we should be perturbed by that precedent that was set that way. Now, the fact that the president does get the right to nominate people to the Supreme Court, I believe that's expressed in the Constitution. historically, nominations haven't always gone the way the president wanted them to go. There have been Republicans nominated to the Supreme Court that have made very liberal decisions. There have been liberals nominated to the Supreme Court that made very conservative decisions. So there's not, it's who nominated the candidate isn't necessarily a predictor of their decision-making lean. But at the same time, the fact that the process is so politicized and contaminated right now should be of concern. Now, whether or not the president should be allowed to nominate people to the Supreme Court, that's a deeper constitutional question that you're right, no one has raised.
Okay. Thank you.
We're speaking this morning with Loretta Ross about Samuel Alito nomination and also about human rights issues in general. In response to one of our previous callers who raised the question about what do we do?
What can we do, right?
And you talked about grassroots organizing and you talked about preparing for a world, preparing for a nation if Roe v. Wade is overturned.
It's overturned.
And I appreciate it hearing, first of all, you alluded to the movement earlier, but also I was wondering if you could talk more in terms of ways in which people are organizing in different communities, not only to address reproductive rights, but other ways which might give words of encouragement to those who feel discouraged.
Well, one of the more exciting things I've seen over the last 10 years is the growth of what I call the U.S. human rights movement, where people are going back to the tactics of W.E.B. Du Bois in the 1950s and making human rights demands and claims that this country is trying its best to ignore, because we tend to think of human rights as the tortured prisoner overseas, and we rarely think of homelessness or lack of access to health care or violence as human rights violations that take place in this country. And the United States spends so much time admonishing people around the world, but never allows us to bring human rights home to address what's happening in the United States. And so I'm seeing a bottoms-up human rights movement grow, where people who are working on workers' rights or women's rights or immigrant rights or juvenile justice issues are all saying that these are human rights violations. And in a sense, it feels like people are picking up where Dr. King left off, because in 1968, Dr. King called on us to build a U.S. human rights movement, and we never did. And so it looks like the younger generation is hearing that call and building that movement from the ground up. And I'm not talking about a movement that spends its time at the United Nations, but a movement that's in community that's saying that Medicaid is a human right, health care is a human right, workers' rights are human rights. And in many instances, they're taking lawsuits to international bodies against the United States for things that it's doing that violate people's human rights. So I'm excited by what I see as a growing human rights consciousness in this country. And I have to honestly say that the rest of the world has been waiting for the American public to get this consciousness. Because many of the times when I go overseas, people will say, well, we could fix our own problems if you could get the United States off our back.
All right.
And so for a U.S. human rights movement to emerge and do just that is really an exciting time to be an activist right now.
You're listening to KBOO. This is More Talk Radio with Cecil and Celeste. We're speaking with Loretta Ross, and we'll go to our next caller. Good morning. You're on the air.
Hello. I understand a lot of people do pornography, and a lot of people do child pornography. I was wondering if this would put a bigger load on the need for abortion, and also a bigger load on the Child Protective Services. Also, the sex trafficking that I understand is going on in this country, too. I wonder if it would do the same thing to the need for abortion and a bigger workload on the Child Protective Services. I'll listen. Thanks.
Okay. Well, I've never heard a link made between the availability of a pornography and abortion. So that's an interesting link. What generally causes the need for abortion is simply the plumbing. Many women who have babies already decide that with an unexpected and unintended pregnancy that they cannot afford or choose not to have the second or third pregnancy, have that come to term. So when you look at the data, most of the women who get abortions are women who already have one, two, or three children. They're the ones deciding whether or not they're going to terminate. So I don't think their decision is being made in the context of whether or not there's availability of pornography out here. At the same time, I also don't like linking the availability of abortion or the unavailability of abortion to an increase in child welfare or increase in child abuse. I think those are theories that have really not yet been proven. But what has been proven is that when a family has the right and the option to make the best decisions for themselves, they usually are better off economically, socially, and morally, because then they can do intelligent planning about their future and not just be trapped by biology.
Thank you. One thing that raised a concern for me, and maybe it's because I'm living in Oregon and because I'm a male, but recently I've been reading and in terms of abortion, and in point of fact, although Roe v. Wade is the current law of the land, abortion, the availability of abortion or reproductive choice is not the same in every state and every county in the United States. Could you share some of that in terms of what women in different parts of the country face?
Well, 84% of the counties in the United States do not have an abortion provider. So you have to be lucky enough to live in the 16% of the counties that have a provider to not have to undergo an overnight or an extended trip in order to access a provider. We have other access questions, of course, because if you're poor, Medicaid will not pay for an abortion. So quite often poor women are having to choose between paying the rent or terminating a pregnancy. I mean, those are not healthy choices. Those are not good choices. And so with the Hyde Amendment that was passed in 1976 and affirmed by the Supreme Court yet again in 1977, you have eliminated access for poor women, for women on Indian reservations. What's interesting and what's so painful to witness is that we get a lot of letters from women in the military, women in Iraq, serving our country, but our country won't pay for their health care when it comes to them deciding to terminate a pregnancy. And discrimination within the military that somehow only affects women. Again, we should all be alarmed about that, because why should a woman who's in the service serving our country have fewer health care rights than a man in the service serving our country? Again, raising up those 14th Amendment discrimination issues. And we've allowed the country to create a 50-state patchwork of abortion laws. And that's not right. I mean, I don't know how else to say it. You should have the same rights as an American, no matter what state you live in. And because you live in Mississippi, you should have fewer rights than if you lived in Oregon. And to allow the state's rights claim around very important issues like health care, I even interrogate whether states are the best to be in charge of the educational system. There's so many things that constitute discrimination in our country, and we accept it as business as usual and don't challenge it, I think, with the strength and the determination we should.
And we'll go to our next caller. Good morning. You're on the air. Hello? Okay, maybe not. we're talking about both how having Alito on the Supreme Court can affect reproductive rights, and we've talked about how having him on the court with regard to his decisions or his past decisions regarding reproductive rights would be threatened and undermined because he sees the need to perhaps go back and reinterpret it. But I'm really curious as to how he views another aspect of life, and that's with regard to death penalty cases. Now, you expect a measure of consistency. Well, the human being expects it, even though it doesn't necessarily work toward it. But it seems that he is expected to not support life with regard to the death penalty.
Well, there is that inconsistency.
Yeah.
Within our so-called culture of life proponents, they tend to think that, first of all, when it comes to young people, they only concern about life from conception to birth, and they're not joining us in supporting increased child care or, you know, public education or health care for kids. I mean, there's so much that they're not supporting in terms of young people. But also they are amazingly silent when it comes to opposition to the death penalty. They often oppose retesting of DNA to see if people have been wrongfully convicted and things mm-hmm. like that. I mean, it's a mess. And if you're looking for logical consistency amongst people who purport to have this cultural life credo, you'll be looking in vain because they are not consistent. They are opportunistic. That's what they are. I mean, how in the world could the whole country come to a standstill when it came to Terry Schiavo? But as our earlier caller said, not really give a damn when 100,000 Iraqis die. It's just amazing.
It is amazing. I'm one of these people who sees life as sacred across the board, so I can't understand why you want me to be born, but you don't want to feed me. You don't
exactly.
want to educate me. So my whole thing is let me be born and then, you know, take care of me so that I can be a contributing member of the society.
And why these people are not concerned about the hundreds of thousands of kids in foster care and no one is trying to adopt them and the kids who are really suffering in this country. If the people who are opposed to abortion were out there supporting us, who are trying to make the world better for children who are already here, I'd probably have a lot more respect for their position, but they're not.
Recently, I was talking to a colleague of mine who expressed her opposition to abortion, but also mentioned her concern about how we should, as you and Celeste was speaking, should be consistent in terms of advocating for children everywhere. Are there ways in which you see that those who have been so militantly against abortion rights and those who are pro-choice can find common ground, perhaps in terms of looking at the needs of children and healthcare and education? Are there evidences of people coming together around common issues?
Well, the thing that confuses me about the opponents to abortion is that they also oppose our efforts to get birth control out there. Which is the way to prevent abortion. I mean, nobody ever wakes up in the morning and say, oh, I'm having a great day, let me have an abortion. I mean, if we could prevent the unintended pregnancies, we would reduce the need for abortion. But they are opposed to the morning after pill. They're opposed to RU486, the abortion bill. They are opposed to so many preventions of the need for, preventives for the need for abortion that it really does seem about a plot to control women rather than a plot to prevent abortion. So that's one thing that I think that those who are opposed to abortion and those who are supportive of abortion could agree on. Well, let's prevent the pregnancies. Another thing that concerns me is that they are opposed to giving our children competent, fact-based sex education in the mm-hmm. school. If young people were given an opportunity to know the facts, they would make better decisions. But what we're seeing with this abstinence-based curriculum that basically is the ideological equivalent of holding a Bible between your knees and hoping it doesn't fall out is young people who are denied accurate information about sex are engaging in high-risk sexual behavior that as long as there's no vaginal penetration, they don't think they're having sex. But we're seeing an incredible rate of transmission of HIV/AIDS through anal and oral sex. There was just a study out a couple of weeks ago that says that 15 and 19-year-olds have engaged in oral sex at an unprecedented number, never before seen in history, because they're being persuaded that as long as they don't do the old vaginal sex thing, that they're not having sex. And so we're not protecting our children by giving them accurate information with which to make better decisions. And so I think those opposed to abortion and those supportive of our abortion rights could agree, could find some common ground, that the best way to prevent abortion is to ensure that kids have quality sex education and not just this just say no message that doesn't work.
You know, working with middle school youngsters, I'm sad to say that it's not just the 19-year-olds or the 17-year-olds or even the 15-year-olds. It's children who are younger than that. And whereas I might have some differences of opinion on other components of prevention, I have to steadfastly support education for the very reason that you mentioned. We want people to make informed choices, but we don't want to inform them.
Exactly. And then we want to punish them when they get it wrong.
You know, and so it's frightening because there is some common ground, and I can see how there can be some differences with regard to some of the other measures that you mentioned, such as the morning after pill, or the others, because there's controversy as to whether or not the pills themselves cause an abortion. There's still some people who have that particular belief. But education, you can't beat that at all, and that seems to be the strongest position for common ground. And it's not really being considered as it should be by choice opponents.
Well, actually, we have on the other side in the pro-choice movement long advocated for the placement of school-based health clinics in the schools, mm-hmm. because for a lot of young people, their only access to health care may come through the school. I remember as a poor black girl growing up in southern Texas, my first opportunity to be examined by a dentist took place at my school because my parents couldn't afford to take 8 kids to the dentist. And so I don't think the situation has changed that much, that if we had school-based health clinics in the schools, children would have greater access to health care, they'd get more useful information, they'd have a confidential place they could go and talk to about the issues they're afraid to talk to their parents about, and it is just normal teenage angst not to want to take your embarrassing stuff to your parents. And we would have a healthier and saner society if we did that. But when Reagan got elected in 1980, all discussion of school-based health clinics dropped off the map. And right now, the only state that I know of that has school-based health clinics is the state of New York. We need to, again, aggressively campaign to put health care in the hands of our young people where they have access to it, where they can take their confidential questions to, and where they can get accurate information.
Well, you know, with regard to what you're saying about health care, it's not just in terms of policy that we have a shortage of health care in schools. There's just the fact that there is a nationwide shortage of nurses. A few months ago, I was reading how the federal mandate was to have one nurse per, it was either 500 or 700, maybe 750, students, and that in many areas the ratio is as high as one nurse per 1,000 students. So that means that the infrastructure for having adequate health care in schools is not there, regardless of the policies.
Well, that's partially the problem. I mean, many people in my family are nurses and mm-hmm. professionally, and they speak about the miserable working conditions and pay conditions that they're having to endure. We're having to recruit nurses from other countries like the Caribbean and Asia. We're asking people to, we're even, you know, squeezing their visa applications, that they can put on the application that they're a nurse, because we're undergoing such a severe nursing shortage. But we're also undergoing a severe doctor shortage, particularly OBGYN doctors, who are discouraged from practicing, particularly in communities of color and poor communities, because of malpractice.
Malpractice and poor working conditions.
Right. And so I'm not into supporting the tort reform that the Republicans are proposing, where we would lose all our rights to sue a doctor that has messed over us. But at the same time, I think the insurance industry needs to be carefully scrutinized and really ask why they're driving so many physicians out of business. So we've got some major infrastructural problems with our healthcare system that just maintaining Roe will not solve. But as a country, we should demand better. I really do. If we've got enough money to rebuild the infrastructure of Iraq, why aren't we rebuilding the infrastructure of America? I think that's a question every American should be asking. And yet our government is adventurously now talking about Iran and Syria. I mean, give us a break.
Well, you know, the answer would be, oh, that's private money. You know, that's not federal money. That would be the excuse. But, you know, it's all the same in the long run. You're listening to More Talk Radio here on KBOO 90.7 FM in the metropolitan area, 91.9 in the Columbia River Gorge, 100.7 in the Willamette Valley, KBOO.FM on the web. We're speaking with Loretta Ross, who is the founder and the national coordinator of the Sister Song Women of Color Reproductive Health Collective, and author of Undivided Right, Women of Color Organizing for Reproductive Justice. And we've got roughly 20 minutes or so to take your calls, and you can join in the conversation at 503-231-8187, and we'll go to our next caller. Thank you for being patient.
Oh, thank you for taking my call. We have a two, three scattered ideas to pitch out here in the conversation. And one of the things is that the one woman made comment that the folks back there might be psychotic. Sometimes I kind of wonder when I watch the action. At the very least, they are totally drunk on power. You know, if I have needles hanging out of my arms or I'm knee-walking drunk, I'm going to be hauled off to detox and to rehab. And I'm kind of thinking that these are people who need to be put into rehab. They are so drunk on their own power, and which all affects everyone. And I pretty much, as an adoptee, feel that abortion is a better option than adoption, because I think the little soul can float around out in the ether then until it's time to come to a family that's ready for the baby. And I don't know. And I don't know about these international adoptions. I think there'll be a huge blowback that will surface from that in a few years. But anyway, just some thoughts, as I say, kind of scattered, because as I listen to the conversation, then I get lost in my thought and I forget what I was really going to say because something new comes up. But, you know, just some things. And like I say, I think we ought to be thinking about the folks who are drunk on power, because that should not be allowed. And it's what they're working for is total chaos. Yeah. And the more out of control the populace is, the more controllable we are. And I think that's the end goal for these folks. Anyway, thanks so much.
Thank you so much for your thoughts.
Well, one thing the caller made me think of that we have not mentioned yet is our energy policy in this country.
Mm-hmm.
I still want to know what was in those secret memos that Cheney refused to release to the public. And does that have anything to do with why we're paying $2.50 at the gas pump? I mean, Georgia, the state I live in, had the lowest gas prices in America 2 years ago. Now we're only second to California. What happened? Can somebody tell me why we don't have a sane energy policy in this country, and the only alternatives that the Republicans can offer is to drill in Alaska and to destroy the Alaskan ecology? I mean, I think we should have a citizen movement demanding accountability. And to be drunk with power is to say that I'm a government official being paid by the American taxpayer. I can have memo, I can have meetings with energy representatives in my office, enact their policies, and not tell the American public what we discussed and decided. But I don't think I need to see the memo to determine what they decided. I get it every time I fill up my gas tank.
Well, it's no different than people in California wondering what was the meeting that Schwarzenegger had with some of the oil companies prior to his and the those people who provide the energy and the electricity in the state prior to his being elected. So, you know, we expect that there's going to be some double dealings. I'm looking forward to perhaps grassroots movement to support some alternative energy options, such as in I want to say Brazil, where they're actually using ethanol, and they're using sugarcane to produce it, so thereby undercutting the whole need for petroleum, or maybe Iceland that's looking at thermal energy. But, you know, finally other countries are being able to crack those both those economic and political barriers that have undermined their efforts to get out from under the petroleum.
And those are government policy.
Right.
Our government could enact similar policies.
Yes, we can.
Here to do so. But right now we have energy hoes in the White House, so they're not necessarily going to do it. Forgive me for being frank, but they don't have a financial stake in us having alternatives.
I don't think that's one of the seven deadly words. So, you know, in other words, they are beholden.
Well, I'm in a race.
Very much. Yes.
We're speaking this morning.
Beholden to those companies. But speaking on energy, I wanted to say one recent change that I made that everybody can do. When the government of Venezuela offered to send free gas supplies to the people of Katrina, and the United States and its hubris turned them down, you know, we are just too good to accept help from Chavez's government, I did some research and found out that Citgo is owned by, that's how Venezuela gets its oil to the United States, through Citgo. So I immediately switched all of my oil cards to Citgo because I wanted to support the country that was willing to support us.
Mm.
And, you know, that's just one little thing one could do to make a difference.
You know, it's funny you say
that. I hope that didn't constitute a commercial endorsement, but it's a political, philosophical point
statement.
Of view.
It's a statement.
Across.
And this is, you know, we still believe in freedom of speech here.
I don't think we're endorsing. If we are, we'll get our wrists slapped here. In other words, be conscious in how you use it.
Yeah, how you spend your money. I am a conscious social investor. I have a few little stocks and bonds in my little IRA plan, and I look to see where my money's being spent, and I object when it's being spent and things I don't want it spent on. I mean, every one of us has the power to do that, and it takes just a little bit more time to do your homework to find out where your money's being used.
We're speaking this morning with Loretta Ross, who is the national coordinator of the Sister Song Women of Color Reproductive Health Collective, a human rights activist and co-author of Undivided Right, Women of Color Organizing for Reproductive Justice. You're listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up this morning on KBOO at 9 is the OMO Variety, our discussion on health care proposals in Oregon, including the John Kitzhaber plan. Also, a new book and video about Sierra Leone will be previewed. It's called Speaking Out, Women, War, and the Global Economy. At 10 on Health Watch, host Dr. David Naiman interviews Dr. Randolph Neustetter, the author of The Vaccine Guide, Making an Informed Choice. At 10:30 on Earth Watch, host Chris Anderson looks at the possibility of a Virginia company being allowed to establish a shipbreaking and salvage operation in Newport and the potential harm to the environment. And at 11 is Democracy Now! Bolivia swore in its first ever indigenous president yesterday. Author and journalist James Petras will discuss the future of the country, and Canadian independent journalist Anthony Fenton will talk about upcoming election in Haiti. And all that is here at KBOO. And just thinking about what's happening in Bolivia and other places, you know, gives me hope.
Absolutely.
It does.
And we'll go to our next caller. Good morning, caller, and thank you for waiting.
Yes. I just got three quick points. One of the things that people haven't looked at is what a bloodless coup. Now, and what I mean by a bloodless coup is I think that we should employ a general strike, which was employed by over in India when they wanted to overthrow the British, and of course Dr. King. And nobody is talking about overthrowing this government, and to me that's what it's going to take. And because right now we're gripped in the shackles of oppression, and the Constitution is very clear. The Constitution instructs us that when the things that bind us together is no longer serving our needs, it is our duty as patriots to overthrow this thing. And nobody's talking about overthrowing. All we're talking about is trying to work within. And I just want to say that the power base for the president and all three branches of government is the military and the police. And the military is made up mostly of poor people and minorities. And so when you have minorities, black people, Hispanics, and all these other people in the military, what they're doing is they're keeping this regime in power. And I think it's up to us to educate poor people and black people. Don't join the military. Don't join the police. And it's up to us to come together and formulate a bloodless coup. We need to have a general strike if you want to bring this thing down. All these little old knick-knack organizations and all these little tit-tat things ain't going to do it. Dr. King showed us how to end something when it ain't right. What you do is you quit participating. You come together, you organize, and you strike if you want to bring it down. Thank you.
If someone's... He always gets off the phone so quickly.
Because I wanted to ask him, so where was his group so that people could come and join his efforts and be involved?
Well, I'd like to look at some of the things the caller said. First of all, I have to categorically state that I'm not a believer in violence. I don't believe violence solves anything. So his call for a bloodless coup is probably not going to remain but bloodless, because once the state and the military get involved, trust me, they're going to use those very well-oiled weapons that they have at their hands. But at the same time, I look at countries like France, where the workers there are so activated and so mobilized that when they try to cut into those workers' benefits, they bring the whole country to a standstill. And the government quickly finds somebody else to mess with, because they can't stand it when their countries aren't running. I look at the New York transit workers' strike. That was a very effective way of calling the most busy city in the world to a halt while the city had to deal with their workers. And there are ways to do that. I'm not so sure that it takes talking about a coup or what have you, because most Americans are actually quite content with the system that we have, so there's not this radical pressure from the bottom up to come up with another economic system. But at the same time, I've joined George Soros in believing that unfettered capitalism cannot survive, that it has to provide some level of benefits and comfort to the workers to keep the wheels running. And so we do need some deep structural changes. I'm not so sure if a coup is how I would describe it, but we certainly need more worker unity. We need people to understand that even if you didn't live in New Orleans, that rebuilding in New Orleans is important to your life. I mean, we need people to be able to connect the dots up and make a more coherent analysis of what's going on in the world so that they can do whatever they can do from wherever they are.
And speaking of what can we do, we want to make sure we allow you some time before we end to talk about what, if anything, can be done with regard to the Alito nomination from a grassroots perspective. And do we have any other callers waiting?
No,
oh, good. Well, then we can do it now.
Okay. Well, Regarding the Alito nomination, Sister Song has organized its 76 organizations to encourage its members to contact their senators to express in the strongest terms their opposition to the nomination. And if you want to contact Sister Song, I'd like to give our website and phone number, if that's okay.
Please.
Okay, our website is www.sistersong.net, and that's all one word, sistersong.net. And our phone number is 404-344-9629. That's 404-344-9629. And if you have any questions, you can write us at info@sistersong.net. We are encouraging people, first of all, to get educated. You put out there that that's one of your top values. I really do believe that there is a reason they didn't teach the slaves to read.
Yes. Because knowledge is power.
Right.
I don't care how cliched it sounds.
Exactly. So we need to become educated about what's going on in the world. One of my earlier mentors, Dr. James Garrett, once told me that if you want to know what's happening in the world through your newspaper, don't read the front page, read the business section.
Exactly.
And I've always believed in that. I watch kids today reading all of these fashion magazines and all of that. My favorite magazine, expensive as it is The Economist, because I want to know how the capitalists are talking to each other, mm-hmm. what they're mm-hmm. saying to each other. So I read The Economist and The Wall Street Journal. And I'm
and
really
the World Financial Times.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
That lovely orange paper.
Yes.
I'm tired of being dumbed down by the mainstream media, and so I watch alternative media. I look at Democracy Now. I mm-hmm. listen to shows like yours. I actively continue the process of education, and I'm a great-grandmother, and I know that there's a lot more to be learned. So mm-hmm. I think the best thing we can do is to educate ourselves about world affairs. And the last thing I'll say is, and stay away from cults. A lot of my friends, for some reason, are saying that they're dissatisfied with the world, and their answer is to join some organization, whether it's a religious one or a civic one, that tells them to turn their thinking off.
So stay away from cults, absolutely.
Right. I know, we're all concerned about the world, but the clue is, the solution isn't to run away from it and let somebody else do your thinking for you.
We're speaking with Loretta Ross, who is the national coordinator of Sister Song, who's also a great-grandmother. Wow. And one thing you mentioned in terms of your activism and things that you are concerned with, and just in terms of talking across generations, what are some of the things that you hear back and that you relay back across generation in terms of organizing? You know, there's a whole generation who grew up where Roe v. Wade has been the law, who don't know of the time before 73. What are some things that you're doing to encourage cross-generation education and conversation?
Well, first of all, I try to mentor as many young people as I can to help them understand. And I don't think mentoring is about showing off your successes and how great you've been. I think mentoring is about showing off your scars and where you failed, and hopefully help them not make the same mistakes. And so staying involved with young people is like a mandate. It also keeps you young, in case you want to know, because I tell people to my great-grandmother, they're in denial. They're like, you can't be. And I'm like, yes, I am. And trust me, and I'm also enrolled in college right now getting a degree in women's studies. So I'm surrounded by 18- and 19-year-olds, and they keep me fresh. And so that's one thing. My mother once said to me something that I think is very, very important. My mother's at the end of her life right now in a coma in a nursing home, so it's not looking good. But thinking about my mom made me think of something she told me when I went to college many, many years ago. And she said, don't ever let success go to your head or let failure go to your heart. And I was like, wow, Mom, did you make that up? That's really deep. And she said, I've just lived that way. And so just because you don't succeed at something the first time, don't let it go to your heart and make you think badly about yourself. Just try it again. That's one thing that I say over and over to young people. Because just because they want to oppress us, there's no reason for us to lay down and take it. There's always ways to resist, to fight back, to do it that way. But the other thing I want to say is that quite often young people have the most exciting, freshest, and original thinking that's out here. And when we neglect to pay attention to young people, we're really cutting ourselves off from some of our brightest minds. It's just the same way we used to tell corporate America that when you wouldn't hire blacks and minorities, that you were cutting off yourself from some of your most brilliant thinkers. Well, the same thing happens when we silence young people, that they bring a really original way of looking at things. Now, I am bewildered by the speed with which they do things, because they can watch 5 television screens at the same time and pay attention to all of them. And my VCR is still blinking, so there's a technology.
A VCR?
There's a technology gap here on my part.
Well, we won't tell anybody.
Exactly. But those are some of the things. And also, I say, if you're going to go into a life of political activism like I've done, keep in mind that life is supposed to be fun. You know, life is fun. People suck sometimes, but life is fun. So don't take yourself too seriously.
All righty. Well, thank you so much for the conversation, the insight, and the enthusiasm.
Well, thank y'all for calling.
Hey, we look forward
to y'all in the future.
We look forward to when you're up here soon.
Okay.
Yes, come by Cable and visit.
In your area, so I'll have my staff let you know when I come out to Portland.
Excellent.
Okay, then. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And you're listening to KBOO 90.7 FM on your dial, 100.7 in the Willamette Valley, 91.9 in the Gorge, KBOO.FM on the web. And coming up
at 9 is the OMO Variety Hour, healthcare proposals in Oregon. You know, the former governor has a new proposal. They'll examine that. A new book about Sierra Leone will be previewed. At 10 is Health Watch. Dr. David Naiman interviews Dr. Randall Neustadter, the author of The Vaccine Guide, Making an Informed Choice, and help listeners puzzle through the many issues around vaccinations. At 10:30 is Earthwatch, and Chris Anderson will look at the possibility of a Virginia company being allowed to establish a shipbreaking and salvage operation here in Newport, and the potential harm to the environment. And at 11, it's Democracy Now! Bolivia swore in its first ever indigenous president yesterday. Author and journalist Jane Petras will discuss the future of the country, and Canadian independent journalist Anthony Fenton will talk about upcoming elections in Haiti. All of that is here on KBOO.
Your community connection. So stay tuned, and we'll hear you here on More Talk Radio next week.